exorcism, giving voice to specific experiences around female sexuality. Here, Suzanne Valadon is shown painting herself, which is rather odd because she's nude, but she's the nude person, but she's also the painter. Some of the experiences use the body in completely different ways, and I'm going to show a series of slides now just to give an illustration of some of the way that women started to use their body in the 70s in terms of depicting sexuality. This is Ray Johnson, Man, Woman, Sink. Marissa Yuda, Gagged Mouth. This is a ceramic piece. Mena Miriam Munsky. This is called Colposcopy. Oh, it's oil on canvas. This is Susan Scott. It's called Obsessive Love Knows No Bounds. And many of us have waited for that damn phone to ring. This is Alice Neal. And this slide and the next both show some sense of woman as nurturer through the breast. This one is Carmen and Baby. This is Alina Sampiro, called Madonna. And yeah, I don't think I have to say anything. This is Deborah Law. It's called Cuddles. And although there is an exchange in terms of the nudity, so first one is nude, then the other is nude, in both situations, there's only one person that seems to be doing the comforting. This is Cynthia Carlson, and I think this is getting closer to the style that many of us are familiar with in terms of Judy Chicago's work, where women started to deal with vaginal imagery and looking into the interior of their body. Now, Judy Chicago is probably the leading practitioner that many of us are familiar with in terms of using the female body, claiming back your own body and imaging it. Now, one of the things that I would like to point out about Chicago's work is that I think that there was a major failure or failing with it, and a shortcoming, and that it failed to come to terms with the way in which things are easily misunderstood as these images as making women being exclusively body-centered, so giving women an exclusively body-centered identity, and also with the ease in which these can be co-opted by male culture in terms of other things that have been done with the same type of body parts. But Chicago certainly has been successful in many ways. And this is a plate from the dinner party, Georgia O'Keeffe. One of the things that she did do in the dinner party is to build a community, a feminist interpretation, and extended that community to include as broad a spectrum of audience as possible, both by the explicitness of the work and the parallel educative functions of the work. So the work was certainly accessible. And she considered her audience in a way that I think is really essential. But Chicago was one of the first people to openly explore sexuality, although within perhaps still abstract imagery. But another thing that she did was she insisted on a feminist reading of her work, and she was one of the first people that did that. Now, I'm just going to go to a blank spot and read a bit again. It is this feminist reading that I think is most crucial to recent work by women artists. That is, how is a work received? Women artists have been consciously dealing with the conditions of reception. How is a work seen? And attempting to analyze, determine, and direct the reading and meanings of their images. This is basically a process of deconstruction where artists first analyzed and exposed meanings that representations of women signify. Then they exposed ideological constructions by questioning the traditional institutions of artist and art. Now, one of the ways that this was done was through a process of reversal, where women represented men in ways that women have always been represented. And the first situation that I'd like to show you is where they appropriated the tradition of art history and painting itself, and the way that the female nude has been used in painting. Now, Linda Nochlin did this, and Christine Conley has already referred to some of these slides, but repetition should reinforce things. This is a slide by Gauguin, Tahitian Women with Mango Blossoms, 1885. And basically, here again, the element of oral eroticism, breasts equated with fruit. This is the slide, again, that Christine showed, by some apples from a 19th century popular French magazine, and then the process of reversal here, where Nochlin has taken a photograph herself for comparison. Another person that did this was Sylvia Slay, and here, this is a portrait of Philip Golub reclining. It's done in 1972. And in this work, although the woman is the artist painting, there's a strange dichotomy in that the male nude is still somehow the more dominant party. He is in the foreground. Also, the mirror shows us the reflection of both his gaze and the artist in the background. And she seems rather tentative in the way that she is representing his image on the canvas. So even though this is a process of reversal, it's a rather contradictory one. This is another work by Sylvia Slay, The Imperial Nude, done in 1975. And here Slay is simply appropriating the idea of odalesques, reclining nudes, from the traditional art practice. And this was the work that it was based on, Manet's Olympia. Another work by Sylvia Slay is The Turkish Bath. This was done in 1973. And it's a very, very contemporary version of this next slide, which it is the source of, which is Ong's The Turkish Bath from 1863. Now, another thing then in this process of reversal where things have been appropriated continues in this notion of the male body instead of the female body having something to do with ownership, where the male body becomes a source of objectified pleasure, an entity to be had, enjoyed, violated, idealized, flesh. Now, sometimes it takes the direction of humor, which is absolutely essential. And I'm going to go through these slides and basically, because of time factors, not identify the artists. This is a photograph. This is an image from a book called Women's Images of Men, which most of these images are from. And it's a book put out by a group of women on a exhibition that happened in London at the ICA in 1980. Now, this slide and the next one are both representative of women positioning men in helpless poses, where they are either unconscious, asleep, or in some way there to be taken, but the men are not in any way participating. This is a photo as well, done in 1979. This is by Jenny Whitman. It's untitled, it's Oil on Board, and here, again, I think you get a sense of wanting to take the male body and making sure that in some way he can be taken. This is by Toronto artist Wendy Code. It's a brush wall drawing. It was done at A Space, 1984. This is Nancy Grossman, male figure, leather over carved wood, 68 inches high. And so the whole notion of bondage. Again, Nancy Grossman. It's called Head Sculpture, leather over carved wood. And this is Mandy Havers, framed figure, leather and mixed media, and it's life size. Whoops, sorry. All right, there we go. That's the one. Now, this whole notion of deconstruction also went into the position where of mass media, where ads were analyzed. And this is the work of Jill Posner, where there was some notion of altering existing ads on billboards, whatever. And it took the form of graffiti. So it manipulated existing images. And there's a book on this that has wonderful combinations of this version. Now, continuing with this notion of intervention and going further is the work of artists like Cindy Sherman, Sorrel Cohen, Sheila Alexander, Barbara Kruger, Mary Scott, and a zillion others, where images or representations of women are, again, appropriated from various discourses, various places where images are produced, such as the screen, magazines, literature, language, family, art history, etc. These images are appropriated, manipulated, and critiqued in some way. And the attempt is to reveal the way that identity and sexuality are constructed. Now, the first work that I'll show you is by Sorrel Cohen from Montreal. This is a piece called An Extended and Continuous Metaphor. And here the artist directly explores the tradition of the artist and picture making, the artist and painting. And I'll show you a detail of this, where the artist is seen as a woman in a self-portrait, also as model, as painter, as her own person. She is also spectator, and she is the one looking. This is a photograph. Now, this is Barbara Kruger's work, where images and text are taken from the mass media, and they are extracted and put back together in a new way. The work points back at the receiver of the information as both consumer and accomplice. So your gaze hits the side of my face. The slightly authoritative voice of the text seems to shock the receiver, for it impacts like a dominant voice, a male voice, but involves you, the viewer, in the completion and production of meaning. And basically that says, we will undo you. The device of the way the image is made, something is framed photographically, is obvious. And it suggests the way that information or people are constructed. It is a symbol of structures that frame and mediate meaning. Barbara Kruger says, how do I, as a woman and an artist, work against the marketplace of the spectacle while residing within it? And again, I think that is the key issue. Kruger's approach is part of a body of recent feminist work that refers to psychoanalytic theory. And I don't have the time or the ability to elaborate in great detail on the area of psychoanalysis, but it's important in that it discusses the unconscious or repressed and censored knowledge that women have, the darkness that is our history. Now this one, we won't play nature to your culture, again is a comment on woman being exclusively associated with her body and nature, sex-oriented, and not with her genius, culture being associated with male production. And this, you are not yourself, really specifically referring to identity and how it is constructed, fragmented, and then hopefully synthesized once again. One of the most challenging artists in this psychoanalytic style is the British artist Mary Kelly, who in her work, Postpartum Document, done 1973 to 79, rejects the imaging of herself or of a woman and completely eliminates any opportunity to identify with her body or the female body in a voyeuristic fashion. Instead, she tells her personal story through the diary excerpts of her experiences and thoughts as a mother during the first 5 years of her son's life. Through the child's development over a specific period of time, the mother, or the personal feminine psychology, is shaped by the sexual division of labor in childcare. Now, what we have here is, this is section four. The work consists of six sections or documentations. And this section is dealing with representations from her child's life. The frayed little bit with the string is portions of the child's blanket. And at the top are imprints of the child's hand, which sometimes is feet, etc. And these become fetishized objects. Objects of desire. Part of the text included in the work is Mary Kelly's own writing. Some has been extracted from various technical and theoretical books on subjects from pediatrics to drawing and language systems. At the end of each section is a diagram from the psychoanalyst Lacan's Schema R. Lacan's Schema R accounts for his theory that the subject is constructed by a loss. In Kelly's Postpartum Document, it is an analogy for the psychic construction of the mother's position through loss. Loss of her own body to motherhood, as well as loss of the child as he or she grows up. And I think this morning, a number of people referred to that in terms of very personal experience. Now, the use of psychoanalytic theory undermines the cultural assumptions about the naturalness of motherhood and places it in a constructed historical context. Challenges stereotypes and that somehow we are only associated with our biology. Just another section from the documentation four. And this is documentation six. In this section, the child learns to write or is attempting to learn to write. So the scribbles at the top are his attempt to learn how to write his name. In this, which is the final stage of the documentation, the child has learned to write his name, and this is where the work ends. where the child now becomes a part of a larger structure and is a loss to the mother. Now, here I'd like to look at Nancy Spiro's work just briefly, because I think that it takes us back to the direct imaging of the body and an attempt to deal with representations of our own body, the female body, in more explicitly sexual ways. But she does it quite differently. And I think that what work within Nancy, like Nancy Spiro suggests, is that it's very conscious of things like the psychoanalytic theory or the deconstructionist notions, but she has gone way beyond it and now is back to imaging the body in sort of a new way. In this piece, this is Back to the Revolution. I think that what she does here is she shows, she doesn't valorize or idealize the body. She shows more of the complexity of the human experience through the body. There's a joyful and exuberant gesture represented within her body, sort of a free-flying body and body-spirit, something like a dance. But she contrasts things. And it's not always clear in all of these slides. Too bad we can't see the real work. But she contrasts real experience of the body in a number of different ways, where there's text here referring to women's cultural position and sometimes the physical pains of torture that women have been victims of. Now, the images here are not spectacles of beauty. They're more signs. And the signs, through their contours and the combination of different things like hieroglyphics and traces, prints, also completely make voyeurism impossible. The images are not just of one body or of body parts, but of woman as a collective subject, woman as a group, a power, woman representing a large number of people. Now, the work is definitely positive in that it is proposing alternative sexual imagery, positive sexual imagery, but its difference from work in the style of Chicago is that it is not a single physical view. It does not mirror the beauty, the sensuousness, the physicality of the woman's body or her body parts. But it provides multiple signs, multiple readings through fragmented elements. She uses prehistoric pictograms, classical references, contemporary references, and they're all mixed into one. So it talks about many things all at once. There is no sense of mastery, but more a quality of imprints, impressions, possibilities. There are tracks, traces of the female voice. The paper itself that it is on is fragile. The images are strong, yet vulnerable. It shows, in some way, a rewriting of history. And it reflects something that, again, Ellen Siu comments on, about women writing through their bodies. Her work is just one of a number of women that are attempting to do this, to write over top of history from their own experience. And this idea is central to a number of women trying to overlay history with their own history. Not obliterate history, but add their history on top of history. And here we would think of Dale Spender's use of history as his story. So there was a show that was done in Banff, she writes in white ink, where Nancy Spiro's work, along with Janice Gurney's work from Toronto and Mary Scott from Calgary, happened about 8 months ago. And in the work, all of the artists in some way attempted to write with white ink, that is the fluid of the woman's body, over top of existing history. This is Mary Scott's work, and the writing at the top is done sort of with a syringe and is overlaid over top of other images. And I just wanted to throw it in to get a sense of that writing over top of history. Now, before concluding, I would like to suggest that the spirit of positivity in Spiro's work is courageous and suggests possibilities for continuing to explore positive and alternative sexual imagery. Other directions that this exploration may go is to represent our desires of the other, the appropriate other, in more gentle and affectionate ways. Objectification is probably necessary for sexual pleasure. We must in some way desire, but perhaps we should feel more positive about the involvement of the other person. And Sarah Kent, in her photographs, I think does something that is much more positive in objectification. Here, I think she captures the joy and tenderness of desire within the lust of her looking. The pose of the subject is not an arranged, manipulated one, but a participatory and involved one. This consent of the object of desire is also contained in images by Lisa Steele and Kim Tomczak. And I'm just going to show briefly three images that were from an ad that appeared in Insight. And Lisa will be talking about these in much more detail when she does her presentation. This is an ad for prophylactics, and it's on one side it says, sometimes we don't need it. And in this one it says, but sometimes we do. And the images from the work the diversity or the sense of this work is that there is a mutual involvement and delight in sexuality and eroticism. The diversity of approaches by contemporary women artists to sexual imagery is broad and reflects the interrelationships between sexuality, desire, and identity. But the underlying attitudes, whether through reversal, positive imaging, or deconstruction, seem similar. A desire to be desired by others, to be desirable to ourselves, and to desire the other all at once and through a continually evolving feminist language and feminist art practice. Thank you.
The next workshop speaker is Varda Burstyn, and Varda is from Toronto. She's the editor of Women Against Censorship, and she's a Toronto sexologist, a film critic, and a writer. Varda.
Was the term sexologist conferred upon me as a sort of honorific label by you? Yes. I've never called myself a sexologist, although, depending on how broad the boundaries are. Closer to me? Is that all right now? Okay. I'm being bracketed, so to speak, by two graphic presentations. And mine is verbal. And I've entitled it Identity and Desire, Women's Experience, or To Arouse or Not to Arouse, That is the Question. I want to say in advance that it's a fairly impressionistic presentation. I haven't tried to follow one particular system of or theoretical paradigm in exploring some of the ideas. As that I had wanted to. Originally, I thought I might even do a little bit of what Foucault says is our obsession, which is to confess sex, but I decided, given how politicized the conflicts were around this, that I would not confess sex. So I'm going to talk much more in the third person. Nevertheless, it is a collection of ideas rather than a sort of a systematically worked out, theoretically watertight presentation. And, okay, well, Foucault's name has already been inserted into the deliberations of this conference, and he's a, or was in any case, a French historian who in his later works turned his attention to sexuality. In a volume entitled The History of Sexuality, which was a rather arrogant thing to entitle this tiny little thing, but he proposed to write six other volumes afterwards, he argued a number of theses, which a number of feminist and gay theoreticians and historians of sexuality have taken very much to heart, or at least to head. And he had a number of very important theses, two of which have resonated very powerfully with a number of concerns that people have had. The first that was that though the psychoanalytic currents from Freud on had talked about the term sexual repression as something that characterized 19th and 20th century Western society, that what he calls the discourse of sexuality, that is all the ways in which sexuality is discussed and analyzed, categorized, regulated, we've had already some examples of that, that this in itself was a kind of, well, far from a repression, it was really an incitement to sexuality, a thing that got us obsessed all the time with sexuality and placed sexuality, thesis two, at the center of our cultural existence. So because of that phenomenon, sexuality has come to occupy a very central place in the cultural identity of contemporary society. I am not a Foucaultian, and Sue Golding is more so, and she will perhaps correct me if I've put it wrong, but these two things have very much captured, well, a lot of imagination, including of people like Laura Kipnis, whose work we saw last night, who in other ways is more of a traditional Marcusean or something like that, but you can see how those ideas have entered into her work. Well, there's something I think very powerful about these ideas, and they've appealed to a lot of people. In their own way, they speak to our sense that sexuality is everywhere. It's everywhere displayed, it's everywhere exploited, and some places, sometimes, if we can relax enough, maybe it's celebrated. But for the most part, it's displayed and exploited. It also speaks to the way that sexual performance, in the sense of erotic as opposed to procreation,